can change the need two ways, fulfilling it or decreasing its existence as a need.
Right. So even in those conditions, as I said, they're both.
You define a state as temporary and reversible. And I'm wondering why so many people in a pathological state like at Pueblo are unable to find their state temporary and reversible.
Well, remember I said that if we think that it's not reversible, we will usually adopt a language that makes it more like a trait. We'll speak of that kind of person. And if you go abroad and ask people about the people in Pueblo, you'll hear things like crazy people. Somebody who says they are crazy people is not somebody who's seeing it as reversible. On the other hand, mental health workers in the field, we're committed to that being in principle reversible. And so that's part of our ideology, and that determines the way we talk. So you say in principle, it's reversible, even though we can't in fact do it now with these people. Well, there's a point to doing that. Because if you think of it that way and talk about it that way, you are probably more likely to find a way of reversing it than if you simply say, well, they're crazy people and what can you do? So there's a certain element of polemic there, but if it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, good. Yeah, look, suppose that I was up here and all of a sudden I started talking to a spirit up here. And I started talking in ways that were different from our normal ways of talking. And if at that time you tried to talk to me, I wouldn't bat an eyelash, I'd ignore you, I'd keep talking up here. And then after a while I'd come back and I'd talk to you. And over a period of time you'd see me doing this occasionally. And you know, the voices are talking to me and I'm talking back. In the absence of any special justification here, I'd probably be locked up. However, if I were in certain other cultures, I'd be high man on the totem pole. Well, in the societies in which I'd be doing okay, doing this kind of thing is one of the social practices, and so by doing this, I would be participating in them. Since we don't have any such social practice, my doing this is a failure in participating in our social practices. So here, I would count as out of it, as pathological. There, I'd count as with it.
What about the need? What's the new definition? What is the need not being fulfilled?
You have to get specific. Because different needs, different pathologies.
You say need is a condition that is not met, results in pathology.
Yeah.
And the individual is not performing.
Yeah. Okay, let me give you a sort of a neo-psychoanalytic reconstruction here. Take the case where I'm talking with some voices. Suppose that those voices represent important individuals like gods or spirits. They're talking to me, and I'm talking to them on equal terms. Now, you say one of the basic human needs without which people can't function is self-esteem. They have to have some standing in the particular community they're in, or they're nowhere. And if in the past I have not had sufficient standing, you say, well, what happened was he didn't have sufficient standing. But since people need it, he made up his own community and his own standing with these voices. And so it was the need for self-esteem or acceptance that was not met back then. And that accounts for why he now talks to these voices. That's a fairly commonplace sort of thing when you're dealing with somebody with hallucinations. it's not uncommon to get a reconstruction, a diagnostic reconstruction of that sort. That there was a need which wasn't met, the result of which is that I am in a pathological state, which is expressed in the kind of things I either do, namely talking to the spirits, or don't do, namely participate in our usual practices.
And isn't pathology by your definition? Because, like,
well, by my definition, nothing specific is pathology.
Okay, but it's okay to be
But you see, if you thought that the fact that every now and then I tune out and talk to voices instead of being here and now, if you thought that was important enough, you'd say this guy's nuts. And then you would need some explanation, and that might be the one that you would arrive at, of why I'm crazy.
In our culture, what is the pathological state? Even though in that other person's culture, everybody talked to their ancestors.
No, that's why I say that if I'm in that culture, and these are my ancestors, and that's what they do all the time there, and that's a part of that way of living, then no. They wouldn't call me pathological.
Well, when you come out of it, now the person's in this culture, would you consider that a pathological state?
You mean if I came from there to here and I'm still talking to my ancestors?
Yeah.
That's ambiguous.
Depends on who's
listening. No, it depends on what you're counting as what. Take a comparable example. Suppose I emigrate from Russia, but I never learn English and there's nobody else around here who speaks Russian. Well, that's certainly going to restrict my ability to participate in our social practices. And on the one hand, you'll say of me, well, no wonder he speaks Russian and not English. That's how he grew up. On the other hand, you might equally well say, but why the hell doesn't he learn English? Since he's so obviously handicapped without it. There's something wrong with him if he doesn't at least try. And there's something wrong with him if he doesn't recognize that his just continuing to speak Russian is somehow out of place. Well, now all of the same thing would hold if I came over here and just kept talking to my ancestors as though I were back there. You'd say, why the hell can't he tell the difference between being back there and being here? Why does he behave here as though he was back there? He's out of touch. So you could work that pretty much either way, deciding on what you counted and what kind of norms you were referring to. It's like this one. If you're thinking about houses, you could say that's an incomplete house, that's a badly drawn house. Or you can say it's a perfectly good square. Often you can't. See, what we have, and that's what we get to in the developmental schema, is some amount of empirical knowledge of cause-effect connections of this sort. And we draw upon those in trying to reconstruct how it happened that a person has the ID characteristic he has. And since pathological states are one of the ID characteristics, the same will apply to pathological states. See, it would be the same problem if we say, you know, Joe is very altruistic. You say, how come? And then I start telling you about how he was raised, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how come. Well, I may not know how come, but maybe I do. So it's that kind of issue.
This is kind of a side issue, but would you be inferring from the observation of the
deathlike? Probably not. In principle, not. So look, if I draw you a house, if I draw you this, would you be inferring that it was an incomplete house? No way.
What about, you're saying medium and pathological state aren't necessarily connected up that way. I'm talking about not the specific, but just the way they're logically connected. That you're saying, if one observes a pathological state, then there must be
a discussion. Yeah. But when it comes to saying what need, that's like saying what figure. Given any given pathology, you have some number of formulations of a need that was not met. You're not restricted to a single need that was not met. In general, there will be more than one description of the same sort, namely, here is a need that wasn't met and resulted in this pathology. Or to put it in a more familiar format, if you have a given pathology, you got it in one of the ways it can be gotten. And therefore, you can't infer from the pathology itself to how you got it. You can draw conclusions, but you can't make legitimate inferences. Okay, anything else on this whole notion of personal characteristics or pathology or need?
It seems that you can use the notion that you developed by need to get away from the cultural relativism in the same way that psychoanalysis does, by looking at what reasons that person would have to engage in that behavior. If you're talking to the spirits, and your reasons for talking to spirits seem to be involved with some deficit in childhood, or some, you know, if the therapist and observer's reasons believe that you're doing that for reasons other than, you know, elements of your genuine culture, then you probably call the identical behavior pathological.
I think that has the same limitation. Try it with blindness. Why am I going like this with a white cane? The answer is I can't see, not because I had an accident 5 years ago. Even though, in fact, the reason I can't see is because I had an accident 5 years ago.
You can start it the same way. Like I can trace it back to those sorts of events.
You can trace it back, but what accounts for my doing it is that I can't see.
You ever think of one of these cases, like, you know, like the Schrieber case, where like the guy goes from, he sees himself as a paranoid, he sees himself as a religious figure, and he has to go from male to female. And the description he gives of his transformation roughly correspond to certain Hindu notions of how people make certain transformations. He's a guy in Germany. And he's a guy that we know in his history had certain homosexual problems, certain things that he has reasons not to examine. We have the identical behavior, or the identical set of statements that would, in some cases, be an example of genuine culture. But we find these statements as indicating the fulfilling of a deficit rather than an expression of a cultural, or an expression of a single seed of the culture.
Even so, the strongest statement I can get out of what you say is that if over here you have a person who's behaving in a certain way and we call it pathological, and over here you have a culture where somebody could behave that way and it wasn't pathological, then over here there is some kind of rationale for behaving that way, and we can try that rationale out over here for this individual and it might help us understand him.
Oh, no. Even within the same culture, let's say that I'm a Hindu, that I go through those, I speak of those transformations, you can come to two sorts of conclusions. Either I'm expressing something that's a genuine representation of my culture, I'm not working off of a deficit, I'm working off of an expectancy. Or you could find that the etiology, the way I got to that point, is because my parents treated me a certain way, you know, that led to a deficit. The same behaviors within the same culture, in some cases, can be called pathological, in some cases, can be called genuine expression, say, for example, religious experience. It's a question of whether the behavior is an expression of a need deficit or whether it's an expression of a participation in a cultural norm or expectancy.
Same story. You have what amounts to a socially pathological history and a socially normal history. You have the same ID characteristic here and the same behavior. It's the ID characteristic that explains the behavior, not the history. And the fact that back here my parents didn't treat me in the normal way, if I have the right outlook, the right appreciation, then it doesn't matter which way I got there. What I have is the same ID characteristic. See, consider this parallel case. Suppose you have three people who now can add and subtract and multiply and divide. And here you had perfectly tyrannical parents who terrorized the kid And the only way you get out is to do this. Over here, you had a normal learning where you had a schoolroom and a teacher who said good or wrong. Over here, you have no school, but the kid picked up a lot and then was able to talk to one or two people and got that. In each case, what he has is he knows how to do arithmetic. He has that ability, and that is what it takes to explain the behavior. These are merely three of the many possible ways one can acquire that characteristic. And no matter what these are like, whether they're social, cross-cultural, etc., it's still going to be the same story here.
Yeah, history, though, may become important in terms of therapy, if it's pathological, not the characters. The therapy might be different depending on what the person's history.
Yeah. But that's because the history probably connects to other ID characteristics and not just a given one. So the kid with the tyrannical parents probably can do arithmetic but has low self-esteem, and if you try to do certain things with him, he's going to react to you in a terrified way. And so you have to deal with him differently because he has that history.
Is what you're saying that ID characteristics have nothing to do with this
guy? No. What explains you're having an ID history, an ID characteristic, is your history. But the history will explain your ID characteristic. The ID characteristic explains your behavior. The history will not explain your behavior. And in this, we're anticipating the developmental schema because this is a good part of what's in there. Okay, well, as I said, this is as much as we want to say about personal characteristics now. Let me make one more general comment and then come back to the place that we started from when we started talking about ID characteristics. Think once more of an observer observing somebody and describing their behavior. And let's make it O and A. Now, think of this principle for giving descriptions. If a person has a given ID characteristic and his behavior is an expression of it, then that behavior requires no explanation. If I'm a hostile person and I behave in a hostile way, then that requires no explanation. In contrast, if a person has a person characteristic and his behavior violates it, that requires an explanation. So if I'm a hostile person and I behave in a friendly way, that will call for explanation. If I don't know how to do arithmetic, but I solve this arithmetic problem, that requires explanation. If I don't know arithmetic and I fail the problem, that doesn't require explanation.
Would you relate that to, you could relate that to appropriateness. In other words, this behavior is inappropriate for this person.
No. If I'm confused and my behavior is inappropriate, that requires no explanation. If I'm confused and my behavior is appropriate, that requires an explanation. Now, this is an example of the notion of fittingness. If the behavior fits the ID characteristic and can be seen as an expression of it, there is nothing there that needs explaining because things fit. It's if it doesn't fit that then an explanation is required, and it may fail either way. Either you don't have the characteristic and you're acting as though you did, or you do have the characteristic and are acting as though you didn't. So this will hold generally for the use of ID characteristics. And as you'll see later, it will hold in an important way for the notion of a self-concept. a person has a certain self-concept and acts accordingly, that won't require an explanation. It's if he violates it that requires an explanation. And that in turn is the major way in which self-concepts change.
If I want to use the term appropriateness, could I use it as a critic and tell the observer that it's appropriate to apply fittingness to A's behavior?
I don't think you want to get that fancy. I think that if you heard O's description, as a critic, you'd either say it fits or it doesn't, or it's complete or not. Yeah, you wouldn't have to go through any further gyrations.
Yeah, it was just exercising.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me add another gimmick on the ID notion. This one is back to pathological state and need. Historically, mostly when psychologists say the word need, they're talking about a motivational concept. For example, when Murray talks about need achievement, he's talking about a motivational concept. When Maslow talks about needs, he's talking motivation. Now, the definition I've given you makes need a completely non-motivational concept. There is no necessary connection between having a need and being motivated to satisfy it. And in fact, we have classic examples of the lack of any intrinsic connection. If you get starved for oxygen, for example, you have no tendency to try to get more oxygen. If you're lacking vitamins, you have no tendency to go get more vitamins. If you don't have enough red blood cells, you're not motivated to try to get more. There's all kinds of needs that you have that not only are you not motivated to meet, you don't even know you have them. So it's already quite clear that in terms of this definition, to have a need is in no way the same and does not imply being motivated to satisfy that need. Now, you might ask, how come psychologists have used the word need then in such a clearly, almost universally, motivational way? And answer number one, which is a polemic answer, but only moderately inappropriate, is you just never know how psychologists are going to talk. I'm serious about that. Some of our most thoroughly outrageous violations of the English language are engaged in routinely by psychologists. Secondly, though, bypassing that one, we can reconstruct a certain line of thought that will make it plausible that you would use need in a motivational way. And it involves the notion of cognizant and deliberate action. As I said, if you're lacking oxygen, you won't thereby be motivated to get oxygen. However, suppose that you believe that you need oxygen. Then you'll be motivated to get it, and strongly. But notice that if you believe that you need oxygen, you'll be motivated to get it, even if in fact you don't need it. So there's still not an intrinsic connection. But because there is this kind of connection, that if you think you need it, you will be strongly motivated to get it. Within this framework, need connects to motivation. Secondly, reference to need is one of the traditional ways of justifying one's behavior. You've often heard the excuse, but I had to do it because my need was great, or some variation thereof. So because of those two connections, the notion of need is, after all, not unconnected to motivational notions. It's closely connected, even though the concept of need is a non-motivational concept. Just to put a little frosting on it, it has to be a non-motivational concept in order to have this motivational implication. I have to believe that I really do need it in order to be motivated to get it. If what I believed was that I merely believed I needed it, I wouldn't be motivated. So it's because it's intrinsically non-motivational that when you believe that you need it, then you're motivated. If you made it subjective, that knowledge wouldn't generate motivation, because in effect, you know that you were making it up.
Now that you talk about me this way, I think I can re-ask my question. What I was trying to get at before was that, what if you engage in a certain behavior, like talking to the spirits, because out of having a choice, you could do something else, but you choose to do that, as opposed to talking to the spirits because you have in many ways no choice because of, you know, the history of your expectations. Mm-hmm. Would you have a tendency in a situation where you have basically no choice, but there's a limitation in your intentional action, possibility to be here, potentially that talk about pathological state?
Yeah, because the ability to give the right motivational priority to talking to the spirits versus doing other things falls under the heading of ability, and you could say there he's showing a restriction in his ability.
But there, it seems, I guess need isn't still the word I'm after, but it seems to me that there is a place you can get out of the cultural relativism.
The whole thing is out of the cultural relativism. It's content free. See, the problem with cultural relativism is that the content differs from culture to culture. The particular practices differ, the norms differ, the problems differ, the situations differ. Everything differs in terms of content. And that's why the only hope of having a culture-free notion is of this form.
But there are the reasons why a person gets to a certain point are important, considering whether that point would be described as pathological or not.
Yeah, but that holds culture by culture, not cross-culture. Even if it's the same reason in both cultures, how could you say it really was the same reason rather than a parallel reason?
It's not a question of what reasons, it's a question of because of the reason, there's a limitation of choice.
Yeah, but again, that's simply the content-free notion of need.
Yeah.
So you still have a content-free formulation.
Yeah, that's
okay. Could you say that one of the side benefits separate motivation from need is that you can more easily analyze the determinants of the person's behavior that way, get things separated out?
Here again, if you included the motivational component in need and called it the thing that you think you want or the thing you think you have to have, you wouldn't have this need schema that in order to cure a person, you just have to make good the need. Whereas if you define it specifically as a condition which, if not met, results in pathology, then by definition, one way of curing him is to meet the need. So things would be very confused if you introduced motivation into the concept of need itself. It works fine if you don't have any motivation in the concept of need and can then connect it to motivational notions. You might. You can certainly try that strategy. If you can identify a need and connect it to the pathology, then one of your strategies would be to meet the need. Now, that won't always work, because sometimes there was a need that clearly was a need that resulted in this pathology, but meeting it now won't help. So it won't always work. But that's clearly one of the lines of approach to treating pathology. And you wouldn't have that in that simple form. if need was a motivational concept. Because there's no guarantee that if you gave me what I thought I wanted, that that would have anything to do with my condition.
So motivation and distortion of need?
Yeah. They say, if I believe I have a need, even if I don't have it, I'll still be motivated.
Does this limit the ability to connect physiological needs to motivational parameters? For example, a rat does not necessarily need to know it needs food.
That's right.
In order to get it. And my question is, are persons any different than that?
Not that I know of. What people want is not necessarily what they need. And be motivated to get something and not need it at all. In fact, it may be bad for you.
True, but the reverse of that is that...
And it may be good for you, and you want it, but you don't know that it's good for you, and that's not why you want it. And that's a nice coincidence.
My question is still, persons are usually motivated to get what they need.
Motivated to get what they think they need.
But a person doesn't even think they're hungry in order to go and grab food.
No, that's true. But like I say, hunger wasn't the example I used. I used oxygen and vitamins.
Okay,
if you're lacking certain vitamins, you're not motivated to get them. Not unless you know you need them.
Physiologically, that's not true.
Yeah. That's my information, and that's the same with oxygen.
A person will gasp underwater.
Right.
If their body, if their brain is it's time to take a breath, even though they're underwater.
Yeah, but they're not responding to lack of oxygen, they're responding to carbon dioxide. See, it's one of those physiological mechanisms that happens to work out well in normal circumstances. Because when you lack oxygen, you have more carbon dioxide. But you're responding to the carbon dioxide, not to the absence of oxygen. So you can be missing all kinds of oxygen, and as long as the carbon dioxide doesn't get too high, you just pass out without any effort to get more oxygen. And you know, there are any number of kinds of needs. You can invent esoteric ones like the number of blood cells in your body. You need a certain amount of them, and if you have fewer of them, I defy you to come up with a story that people are motivated to increase the number of blood cells. So clearly, you can have needs that you're not motivated to meet.
Part of the confusion comes out is there's, you know, a lot of folk stories that you believe.
There may be something in that, but I wouldn't count on it. Okay, next time we'll come back to our original starting point. We've now completed this part. We did this part here. We now move to the role of the critic here. So for this, study the maxims and whatever is said about perspectives and critics in the outline. Well, last time we finished talking about the individual difference or personal characteristic notions. Are there any questions about that material at all? Okay, let me remind you of one of the principles of use that goes with personal characteristics. And that is that if a person has a given person characteristic and his behavior is an expression of it, then that requires no explanation. If a person has a given person characteristic and his behavior violates it, that does require an explanation. So if you see that kind of thing, you know something is missing, you know you haven't fully understood. Now, one of the things that means is that as soon as you give a personal characteristic description of a person, you have chosen, you have made a decision about what it is that's going to require explanation and what isn't. As soon as you decide to call somebody a hostile person, you've decided that when he behaves in a hostile way, that doesn't need explanation. And then when he doesn't, that maybe that does call for explanation. So in a way, the giving of personal characteristic descriptions is the setting of some baselines or points of reference for what it is that calls for explanation and what doesn't. Okay, now, at the end, we went back to our three-way diagram here and said, this formulation of person now completes the role of A here, the general case of a person doing something. In terms of this formulation, we've been discussing this parameter of behavior. As the value of this parameter, you specify that ID characteristic that this behavior is an expression of. And clearly, there may be more than one. A given behavior may reflect certain of my values. It may reflect certain of my abilities. It may reflect my present state. It may reflect some number of ID characteristics. So the value of this parameter, then, is those ID characteristics that this behavior is an expression of. Okay, now we have talked about the observer describer, and now we want to talk about the role of the critic. Recall, we're still operating with this adequacy criterion that says the role of the critic is a special case of the role of observer-describer. And a good formulation ought to enable you to show that the critic role is a special case. Now, for understanding the role of the critic, we need to elaborate one of the forms of description that we've already developed, and that is deliberate action. Remember this diagram. The deliberate action involves distinguishing one behavior from others and choosing one behavior in contrast to others. There you go. Now, this formulation is incomplete. You'll see, as soon as you have a number of behaviors as options, a number of behaviors that could be chosen, and in fact a choice is made, then formally there must be somewhere in the picture a principle for choosing, a principle for selecting one behavior as against others. Otherwise, the occurrence of this behavior as against the others would be a random, mysterious, ununderstandable phenomenon. Now, here we go back to the phenomena and ask ourselves, what indeed do we already recognize as principles for choosing behaviors? And in order to explore that, we can adopt a certain kind of question. Just consider the kind of answers we accept as answers when somebody asks, why did you do that? For example, if somebody says, why did you drink that coffee from the cup? If I say, well, I hear that China is planning to invade Tibet, you won't count that as a strange answer. You'll count that as a non-answer. On the other hand, if I say, because I was thirsty, or because I like coffee, or because I thought it would taste good, you may not believe it, but at least you'll accept that as an answer. So there are some things that qualify as answers to the question, why did you do that? And others that won't. So we already have some distinctions of the relevant sort. Namely, what are some of the bases for choosing one behavior over another? Now, take the kind of answer that says, I like it, I enjoy coffee, well, I thought it would taste good, or it would be fun, or I'd have a nice time doing it. All of those have are related sort of answers, and they refer to a traditional concept, namely concept of pleasure and pain. So we can categorize or summarize that general sort of answer, keeping in mind that there's all kinds of particular answers of this general sort, and call it a hedonic type of reason. See, any answer to the effect, I didn't do it because it would be painful, because it would be unpleasant, because, yeah. Or I did do it because it's nice, it's pleasant, it's fun, it's enjoyable. Either of those sorts of answers will fall under this heading of hedonic reasons. And my saying, I thought it would be nice, or I didn't do it because it would be unpleasant. The because clause is the giving of the reason. Because it would be unpleasant is a reason. Because it would be nice is a reason. Now, this is only one general category within the range of answers that are acceptable as answers. Suppose that in answer to the question, why did you drink that coffee, I said not that it's nice or pleasant, but rather that my blood sugar is low and I need the sugar that's in the coffee. Now, that's not a hedonic sort of answer. Or suppose you ask me why I didn't drink it, and I say it's poison, and I'd sure be hurting if I did. Well, you can see that this kind of consideration is very different from notions of fun or merely unpleasant. This kind of reason we can summarize by calling it prudential. Prudential has to do with what is in my self-interest. If I'm going to be hurting if I do something, then it's in my self-interest not to do it. If it's going to be to my advantage to do something, I have a reason to do it. If I'm going to be hurting if I don't do something, then I have a reason for doing it. If I'm going to be hurting, if I do something, I have a reason not to do it. So our second category we'll call prudential. Incidentally, any case that involves fear and danger will be a prudential reason. To avoid danger is always in my self-interest. Now, suppose that before class, I promised CJ that I'd bring him some coffee, and then when I come in, I do indeed have the coffee for CJ. And you ask me, why did you bring him that coffee? And I say such things as, well, I promised. Or I say, well, since I promised, I have an obligation. Or since I promised, it would be a rotten thing to do not to bring it. Or it would be unfair to promise him and not do it. Well, you can see again a family resemblance among these kinds of reasons. And they certainly are not hedonic reasons, and they are not prudential reasons. They have nothing to do with whether it's pleasant or whether it's in my self-interest. And again, for a categorical summary term, we use ethical.
If the act was in your self-interest,
then I'd have two reasons.
Does that include such things as because he asked me to?
Because he asked me to is non-committal. And you can imagine some continuations. Since he asked me to, I'd be hurting if I didn't bring it, because he'd be on me like a ton of bricks. Or since he asked me to, and I said, yeah, I owe it to him. Or both. So just giving that much, you can't tell what's going on.
How about looking in the army, if you ask a private why he didn't bring out his barracks, he said he was sergeant talking about to you. That has something to do with authority.
Yeah. I think you're anticipating our next one. Yeah. For our next one, take the example that we've already encountered. Namely, I'm walking down the hall and I see you, and you say hello, and then I say hello. And suppose you ask me, why did you say hello? And suppose my answer was, well, it would hardly do not to. Or it would have been awkward not to, or something along that sort. Well, the situation called for my saying hello. Why wouldn't it? Well, here we're dealing with a general notion of appropriateness. And this has three subdivisions, but the overall category we call aesthetic. And aesthetic is a general notion of fittingness. What goes together with what harmoniously? What fits together with what and what doesn't fit? Now, there are three subcategories because we do distinguish in an important way at least three kinds of fittingness or appropriateness or harmony. One is artistic, and that's where we get the general category from. Clearly, when somebody paints a picture, composes a piece of music, writes a poem, they're working within some standards of what's fitting, what goes together with what, and what doesn't fit. Then there is social appropriateness, and that's the case that I just described where we say hello and I say hello, or where the sergeant tells me what to do and I do it because he's a sergeant and I'm a private. Or think of people playing together on a team. And the center snaps the ball and the quarterback throws it to the end. And how inappropriate it would be for the left end to try to center the ball. See, in that setting, it's socially appropriate for each one to do his part because each one has a part to do. So there are considerations then of social appropriateness. And finally, there's intellectual appropriateness. And this involves notions of truth, of accuracy, of precision, of rigor, of ambiguousness, of sloppiness, of relevance. Well, you can continue that list. Now notice this too is pretty directly a case of fittingness. A statement is true if it fits the facts. A statement is correct if it conforms to the requirements. A statement is relevant if it fits the demand of the situation or the person.
Some combination of social and intellectual aesthetic considerations.
What question do you have?
Well, in other words, if you have an ethical reason for behavior, how is that different from some notion of either social or intellectual appropriateness?
How could they be the same?
The statement, it's right to do it. It was only right that I did that. That seems to me a notion of appropriateness as well. I mean, I think a whole system of that is a...
Well, look, let me comment. Any one of these you can put over here and say all of the others are really special cases of this. Now, there are in our intellectual traditions two outstanding theories involving this. The hedonic theory says... No matter what you do, no matter who you are, whatever you do, you are always acting in such a way as to bring yourself some pleasure. And then you say, but look. And they say, well, those are just different kinds of pleasure. There's another theory that says you're always acting egoistically. You're always acting in your self-interest, no matter who it is, no matter what it is, no matter when it is. The behavior is always designed to achieve some self-interest. You say, but what about these? Say, well, those are just different kinds of self-interest. You can, in fact, do the same with these, although it hasn't happened in our intellectual history. You can say clearly, you're always doing what you think is right. And somebody says, but fun? Well, those are just different kinds of different ways of being right. And then finally, see, it's not merely keeping a promise, but also eating something that tastes good. That's a kind of appropriateness. Avoiding something because you'd be sick. That's a kind of appropriateness. So you can work that. However, you're still left with these four, because no matter what you put in here, you're going to have to subdivide it this way anyhow. If you say it's all pleasure, you're still going to be faced with the fact that there are these kinds of pleasure, etc. And since you can do it with any one of these, you know, you might as well forget it and just say, what we have are four. Because any choice, any putting of any one of them over here is going to be arbitrary.
Well, just defining it on what ethical was.
Mm-hmm. Remember, I didn't define any of these. I gave examples. I said, if I say...
That was purposeful.
Yeah. Remember, I said in the beginning that in this presentation, we'll be dealing pretty much with fundamentals all the way through. Therefore, nothing is going to be definable except occasionally. And remember, we did define person, we did define pathology, we did define need. We have defined a few things. But by and large, these things are not definable. And so clarifying is done with the examples, not with the definition. And saying, I have an obligation or it would be wrong, is clearly different from saying, but it isn't true. Or saying, that line in the poem is awkward.
Could I put a word in your mouth and say that what subdivision is used before depends on what the observer is trying to describe? What comes from the observer's own viewpoint? For instance, I may be looking at that private obeying a sergeant, and I may be looking at how well his authority obeyed in the army.
Mm-hmm.
Or the private could say, oh, I did it because I believe in authority. I believe authority is right, which becomes ethical.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you're back to the problem of the observer and that he has no guarantee of being either true or relevant. And so in a case where the actor is operating on an ethical principle, the observer might pick a prudential one and give that description, And if that description applies, you could hardly say he's wrong, except if you distinguish forms of description. And then you see, you might conclude that the actor, under a deliberate action description, he's acting ethically. Under an achievement description, he's acting prudentially. That is, by making use of what we developed over here for the observer describer, you can show in what sense both descriptions apply, and yet distinguish that in one of those applies in a stronger sense, namely as a deliberate action description, rather than merely as an achievement description. And then that will in turn be a basis for making the judgment that what was really going on is ethical and not prudential. Now, from the point of view of the sequence that we're pursuing, we need to develop all of this because the last one is the one we need. That is, we're interested in the critic who criticizes a description of behavior. If you think of the nature of possible criticisms of descriptions of behavior, they will be along the lines of, but is it true? But is it correct? But is it rigorous? But is it precise? But is it accurate? So for our purposes, we need this notion for the critic. No, that's not all there is to it. We need some way of representing the fact that when you have deliberate actions, the choice is made on these various bases, and for specifying when it's made primarily on the basis of one or another. And conventionally, we do it this way. We circle the basis for the decision. So that diagram then represents a deliberate action in which the behavior that was chosen primarily on the basis of this. And if you ask this what, see, the category term for these is perspective. The reason we call each of these perspectives is that there is no behavior that falls outside the scope of each one of them. There is no behavior of which it would not make any sense to ask, would it be fun to do? Would it produce painful results, etc.? There is no behavior of which you couldn't ask, would it be in my self-interest to do it? There is no behavior that you couldn't ask, do I have an obligation? Is it the right thing to do? And there is no behavior of which you couldn't ask, is it fitting? So for each and every behavior, these viewpoints are applicable. And since they're applicable to all behavior and each and every single behavior, there is no way to incorporate them as a parameter of behavior. So instead, we deal with them as perspectives, the scope of each of which covers all behavior, and add something to our notation and representation.
Could you explain again why it wouldn't apply as a parameter?
It's not peculiar to any given behavior. The values are peculiar. You specify a value here. There's just enough logical difference so it would be awkward to just add a reason parameter. Say. In point of fact, you get this this parameter, you will encompass the reason. So because if the significance of obeying the sergeant is that I'm doing what is right, then the fact that I chose the obedient behavior on the ethical basis will show up in the description of the significance. So in that sense, the fact that reasons are very close to being parameters of behavior gets shown in the fact that here you incorporate the information. On the other hand, for purposes of use, we often want to identify the reason per se. And that's why this kind of notation.
There's a hierarchy there. It resembles Maslow's hierarchy.
Perish the thought.
I was referring that you're putting a value on these. No. But I wonder if your hierarchy, if there's a hierarchy, or are those categories by accident?
They're not by accident, and there's no intrinsic order. You might say this is a statistical order. If you ask people to think of reasons, this is the usual order in which they come out. As most people think of pleasure, pain first, and then something to do with potential, quickly followed by this, and then after some time period, some of these. And you can easily perform that experiment in a lab where you have people who you can ask the question to, and I think you'll find this fairly regularly. If you're dealing with a group, if you're dealing with an individual, no, some will think of these first, etc. And here again, it's simply a combination of history and convention, since when we first started working, it came out in this order. Ever since then, I've been writing them down in that order. Occasionally, I slip up and write them down in a different order. And keep in mind, there is no intrinsic order. There is no hierarchy. I think we showed that by showing that you could take each of them and say all the others are special cases of it. So there's no hierarchy built into these or these. Okay, consider this then a more complete form of representation of a deliberate action. Now, let's perform some deletion operations on this. Keep in mind, we have first put in all of this stuff. And keep in mind that when you have a deletion operation, you don't take it that the things you're not talking about are not there. It's just that you're not talking about it. So if we delete this, and this, and this, and this, we're left with an achievement description. However, it's the achievement of a deliberate action based on this kind of choice. And now this one, let's delete everything again, and you have another achievement description. And the achievement description is also that of a deliberate action, but without necessarily this. And now let's take it that this action represents the giving of the description by the observer. This action consists of something that you would put in quotes, namely, he says, he's sitting in a chair. So the description, he's sitting in the chair, or rather giving that description, is this action. And the critic considers the giving of this description as a choice of behaviors that the observer chose to give this description and to engage in that behavior, in contrast to any of the other behaviors he might have engaged in. But he's only interested in the result, namely, what description did he come out with? He is not interested in the motivation, the skills, etc. He's just interested in what description he came out with. And he contrasts or compares this with this. Namely, the description that he would have come out with if he were picking descriptions on the basis of this intellectual standard. Which is to say, if he were picking descriptions on the basis of truth. Because keep in mind that you can pick descriptions on some other basis. You can pick descriptions on the basis of convenience, on the basis of whether it would be to your self-interest, basis of whether it would produce pleasant results, or on the basis of whether it's true. So this represents the case where the selection has been based in terms of whether it's true rather than on some of these other possibilities.